All right, well, thank you very much. And actually, I left the... I like these five lines on the floor that just happen to be here. They reminded me of something, which is we're talking about harmony. Harmony is actually on projective momentum space. In that, a node is a point in frequency space, which is momentum space. And harmony is a ratio between different frequencies. And so the study of harmony is actually the study of projective momentum space. of course, harmony doesn't always mean everyone agreeing either. It can have discords, it can have resolutions, it can have all sorts of things going on in harmony. I suppose that's part of the theme here. Musicians don't know about projective spaces. They take logarithms here, and these are actually representations of logarithms here, but they don't know they're doing that. Secretly, we do. And that brings out the usefulness of notation and representation of things. And this is a notation which is very good for musicians to understand music with. And what we're looking for is something that will represent the music of gauge field scattering amplitudes in an equally marvelous way. And so what I want to convince you of is that at least some of the answer, some clues to the answer, something about it lies not in projective momentum space, as in music, but in projective momentum twister space, similar properties. All right, so I'm going to start off with the very thing that Marcus drew attention to in his talk last week, which means I got to spend a bit of time writing up this ghastly long expression on the board, since I was forbidden to produce any computer-based things, which is good, really, because it means I can't just flash all these expressions past and then move on to the next one in the way that people do in seminars. We really are seriously interested in this extraordinary rational function of momenta, which I'll remind you of. Well, it's that plus the similar thing on the delta function of the sum of the six momenta, and that gives you the amplitude for the NMHV, what's called split helicity amplitude. So it's not just the general one, it's the one where you've got three, in the color ordering, you've got three adjacent negative and three positive ones. And this is basically the simplest possible thing we can look at. I mean, this is not complicated because I'm trying to do something complicated to look at. This is the simplest example of an amplitude higher than MHV. And so question is, what does this mean? What does this summation mean? And what's more, why on earth, how can we see that this actually equals another completely different looking expression, which on the face of it just bears no relation at all. Do put these things on transparencies, but perhaps the very effort of writing it out serves to remind one that it's not a very nice thing to have. And of course, while doing it, you notice all sorts of features of it. All right, this is a workshop, so we need some actual work, I guess. All right, now that is supposed to be equal. And perhaps I should have said how this is similar. Perhaps I'd better write it down, because I want to draw attention to the singularity structure, which you only see the whole thing. Okay. Right, well, the interest of these things lies in the singularity structure, how these things can become singular. And these things here, these are perfectly all right, because these correspond to these. I mean, that's just S1, 2, essentially. But the point is that these ones don't correspond to physical singularities. They cannot possibly occur in the Feynman diagrams. And nor can these. And so we can tell from that alone that those must be, well, they're removable singularities when you think of these as complex functions, indeed what they are. And it must be that these two, because that one doesn't appear in that expression, those must actually cancel. And similarly, this one must cancel with that one with that one, and that one with that one. And it seems a bit miraculous that that should be so. And certainly not easy. Well, in fact, it is so, but it's definitely not easy to show that it's so. And it's only so on the support of the Feynman function, which we thought of as just purely algebraic constraint on complex momenta here. The fact that the momenta are real here doesn't make any difference at all. It's really, this is a relationship on complex momenta here, built up out of the product of two spinners, spinner and conjugate spinner. All right, so how? So that was the problem, let's try and investigate this structure. And it's bedeviled people who understand this, and it's marvelous to get these expressions at all, and when they are obtained. And of course, there are other expressions too. I'll come to that at the end. I mean, these are not the only expressions. There are others too, in fact, which these spurious poles don't appear. And we would actually like to see those and understand how those are related as well. But these are important because they come directly out of the BCSW recursion relation. But so basically, you get one of these by choosing one pivoting method for the BCF induction. And you use another one. So we know that it must be the same, but it's not at all easy to say why that is. Well, we know lots of things about these expressions which are not manifest here. And so one thing we know is that actually there's a conformal invariance involved in these expressions, which you can't see from looking at these as algebraic expressions, but it is comparatively, well, it is well understood from lots of different points of view, and it's a confluence of ideas that come from Witten's twister string, old twister diagram theory, twister actions, and the Grassmannian picture. They all come together and give a picture where you can represent basically each momentum here, you can represent as the momentum part of a twister, and the conjugate one as a derivative with respect to that twister. And so there are twister representations which by making those identifications, the dependence on the infinity twister I here actually disappears. That's only in the representation and not in the actual object one studying, and one gets out the marvelous conformal invariance of the actual object. That's comparatively well known, but that structure doesn't shed light on this particular problem of these spurious poles and the strange nature of these rational functions, what they're actually telling you. These representations give you these pieces without explaining anything about the way that they're built up, what these additions mean here. Now, of course, that one reason for that is that there's another structure in these things which hasn't been taken account of here, and that's the structure of dual conformal symmetry, and which you can see that, we can see the tip of its iceberg in the fact that all the objects which enter here are consecutive momenta here, every one of them here, like that. So that's intuitively quite... One can see why that's going to... It's not unreasonable that should happen, because this is based up on a Feynman diagram tree, and the only momenta which can occur on the internal lines are ones which are built up out of the leaves on the edge of the tree, and if it's written out in a planar way, they're naturally in a consecutive order. So that's not so surprising, but it's not obvious in that either that these pieces of the amplitude, as opposed to the total amplitude, will also have that property. And nor is it obvious that it isn't just the question of the additive structure there, but actually there's a conformal structure that that when expressed in terms of region space, then the amplitude actually is going to have this invariance under when a region goes to x when it's inverted. And that's actually going to leave that object invariant. That you couldn't see just from that fact. But that's something we would like to incorporate into the description in some way. What I'm going to do is to incorporate the dual conformal symmetry into a new description of these objects in a way that all the additive properties become absolutely transparent. All right, so although in a way I'd like to leave these expressions on, they will have to go, I'm afraid, while I go on to the next bit. So. Alright, so luckily it's extremely easy to do the next step, which is to define momentum twisters. In fact, it's just absurdly easy, isn't it? So just remind you first of the twister, I'm going to use the original Penrose symbols for the two classical parts of a twister, with a symbol of pi for one part and the omega for the other. People may be more used to seeing a lambda and a mu. But there is some sense to using the symbol pi, which is that it's the square root of the momentum. So that's actually got pi a prime pi twiddle a is the momentum here. That's, I mean, that's rather the point of it. So it's better just to remind you that the pi's have got to do with momentum, and that's useful here because we're actually picking on as being momentum. Yeah. So that's the idea. We've got the relationship with space-time. Is simply given by that, so we shall talk about a point being on the alpha plane of the twister if that relationship is satisfied. And of course here the difference is, well here the x's now to be thought of as points in momentum space, and in particular in the regions space of momentum with which everyone will be familiar. So that's extremely simple, and in fact now the next idea is simply to draw I like these because it's just like I did at school with triangles of forces. I don't know if anyone old enough to remember doing that, but when you have three forces in statics, old-fashioned statics, and you have three forces adding up to a point, they taught you to draw a triangle with the forces going around like that and so on. It's just the same idea. I like things which just school math. So if we've got the delta function satisfied, we have got a polygon, because I can't draw all the pink null. But anyway, we've got lots more here. And now I've got these all defined regions in the normal way. And that's extremely simple to define. Let me start off with this edge here. I'll define Z1 to be the twister given by I x 1 a primed pi 1 a primed pi 1 a primed. So I'll just take the and since you might say this is, let me see, this is x, right, so make sure I've got my things around the right way. I've got x 1 P1 is x1 minus x0 here. Yeah. That's it. Actually, I mean, that's the definition of what momentum twister is. It's just that, just given by that formula. And you might say, well, that's a bit arbitrary. Why did I choose x1? I should have written it down here because I was a bit clearer. Belongs, I guess, associated, the twister associated with that edge. Why did I choose x1? Why didn't I choose x0? Well, I could have put, I think it's also, it's the same thing, you see. It doesn't matter which one I choose, because by definition, that means that p1, by definition, that's equal to 0. So that means that x1 a prime by a prime is equal So it doesn't matter which of those two I write. And you go around and similar way, it defines what Z, the first momentum twist is, and the second one will go right round. And these conditions are all consistent by virtue of momentum conservation. I mean, this is the essential point in the fact that the momentum conservation relation holds gives you the existence of the X's, which makes this definition work. So that's it, actually. I mean, that's the tutorial on momentum twists. We're finished, because that's what they are. The rest of it's just applying that idea. But let's just see what we've actually done. What we've actually done is to map 2n spinners, I a prime n of them there, and I of the conjugate ones, subject to four constraints. Is that delta function's got four equalities of complex numbers in it there. And those are highly non-linear constraints on these. That's the point. In fact, if you write them out as spinner components, they're quartic conditions. It's very, very, very difficult to make use of. These have been encoded into another lot of 2n spinners. Well, the pi's are the same, but the omegas have been constructed by this definition. Now, what's happened to that 4? Well, of course, there's an arbitrariness in what x0 was. It's just the familiar fact that if you're defining a region space, it's an affine structure. It doesn't care where you start, or if you like, your triangle of forces when you draw it on the page doesn't matter where it's drawn.
So you gave a prescription for going from the momenta to the z's.
Yes.
Let's say I give you the z's, and you reconstruct the...
Yeah, that's reversible there. Yeah.
What is the formula?
I think that would be to reconstruct the skewing of two neighboring z's gives you the corresponding x. Yeah. So that gets the x part out of it, and then that part of the z gives you the pi. So the skew of z1 and z2. Automatically gives you what? P2. And then the pi part of the Z twister gives you the pi directly. So that gives you the information. I'll come to this in a moment. So I'll describe this more geometrically in a moment. But it is actually a simple geometrical idea.
The fact that pi and omega, so the mass dimension and the momentum twist, or the mass and dimension is not really inverse of each other.
Yes, that's absolutely true.
So
yes.
Does that come in?
Yeah.
Something funny comes in
because of that? Yeah, that's an interesting point about when you talk about dimensionality of these things here. And it's true that when I use the infinity twister of his, it's got the opposite dimensions from the dimensions in which you'd find in when the twisters are used for X space. I mean normal configuration space. That's true, and that's an interesting thing. I don't know. I mean, I don't. I haven't got a special interpretation to give you, but that's a point that's worth noting. I agree. All right. So what's happened to the four constraints? Well, they've gone into this the fact that there's an arbitrariness in this, the z's are not uniquely defined. They're uniquely defined up to a group of translations, complex translations in space-time, up to freedom of what do they look like in this space? It's a subgroup of SL4C, namely the subgroup corresponding to the complex translations in space-time. But that you can characterize as just the ones which leave the infinity twister invariant. So that's a way of characterizing what this subgroup is. They're just the ones that leave the I object invariant. So that's a very simple idea. whereas these four non-linear constraints are very hard to use. I'm just thinking from a practical computational point of view, actually trying to show the identities with these objects actually means having to apply these non-linear identities time and time again in a way that's not easy to do, whereas seeing the structure of the of these just linear transformations and just knowing that linear transformations which lead to infinity twists are invariant is a simple thing. But of course, anyways, this contains exactly the same information. It's just a one-to-one coding, well, provided certain, provided, in fact, it's one-to-one provided that all the objects like S1, 2, S2, 3, etc. are non-zero. In general, we're going to have that condition now because all our scattering amplitudes will be singular on those regions. So away from those regions, it's a one-to-one mapping, as we'd like. Now, of course, it was arbitrary that I said I'll choose twisters rather than dual twisters. I could equally well have chosen the dual structure. And what would happen if I'd done that? Well, I could have made just the same definition. I could find W. That's a lower index for the dual object, and that would look like it's exactly just the dual object there. I could have done all that and gone right around the polygon, done just the same things. And there's really nothing to choose between these two, but of course their information is redundant. All the information that's in here is also in these as well. And what's the relation between them? Well, the relationship between them is very beautiful and simple and it's easily drawn as a picture. Once you have a structure like this, imagine going around the loop like this, and then you've got W1, W2, W3, W4. Well, these are orthogonal. Each one's orthogonal to its counterpart, but it's also orthogonal to its neighbours. So all these straight lines indicate orthogonality, and this goes right round the
loop.
So that means that gives you an explicit way of getting the information of any W
from the neighbouring Zs.
In fact, the W is just given by the anti-symmetrization of the, it's easy to see geometrically. If I've got three neighbouring Zs, Z1, Z2, and Z3,
they define a plane.
And that plane, indeed, corresponds to,
is that plane. It's said projectively.
And correspondingly, if I've got three
neighbouring planes, they define a unique point.
And that indeed is
that point. So it's a very, very natural geometrical way. That means anything I write in terms of the Zs, I can immediately write if I choose in terms of the Ws, and vice versa. It's just the same information in a different way.
I have an explicit formula,
the ith W,
yes, I have the epsilon automating tensor onto the z,
I minus one
z, the I z, and the I plus one z divided by these factors, which, as I said, must be non-zero for the formalism to work. This illustrates the dependence of this one-to-one correspondence on the non-vanishing of all of these objects. Now notice that's an example of a relationship which is invariant onto the subgroup of SL4C, because the epsilon is by definition going to be independent under any special linear transformation, and the subgroup I was talking about is the one which leaves the infinity twist earlier invariant as well. So this relationship is one which doesn't care if you do the complex translation. So that's an example of, and all the ones that we'll meet later on have the same character. They're built out of epsilons and i's. And if they're only built out of epsilons
and I's and M's and twisters, then they're going to be things which are properly invariants of the momenta. Now, in between the points and the planes, we have the lines, and that's easy too. Well, that's the point I alluded to earlier.
So, going.
Yeah.
The Z's are unconstrained.
Well,
the freedom.
You can think of the first one as being unconstrained, and all the others are determined thereafter, given what momenta are.
So, it's a translation of the Z's. So you had a constraint before in the P's.
There were
four constraints and two spinners.
You
ended up with two end spinners, constraints.
Well, there are.
The freedom of the person.
That's right. So it's really like
the regions.
It's the coset. I mean, it's the quotients of here. It's not two end spinners, but that divided by four dimensional freedom.
In the same sense as the regions.
So it's a two end minus four dimensional set.
But the difference between the regions is that now the on-shell condition, the right-like nature of the P's is on that.
Yes, that's right, yes. So that's the crucial point, which now that the momentum conservation has got coded into the very definition of these things, and it's not an extra thing which we put onto the outside.
Yes.
That has to be satisfied even for this structure to exist.
Right, so that's right, even to be defined.
This picks out a particular cyclic order. I mean, so far...
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And you could do this for any permutation of the pieces. Yeah.
No, that's a very good point. It absolutely depends, because it's to do with dual conformal. I mean, it's a very simple idea here. If it's dual conformal symmetry, I can represent the conformal theory using the twister algebra. That's all I'm doing. But it does depend on having that dual conformal symmetry. So it's implicit that I have an ordering given by being in a certain color sector. Now, in fact, if you wanted, find these for an arbitrary ordering and use these coordinates for anything you like, so for instance the gravitational amplitudes, or you haven't got a natural ordering. It's just that you won't get simple expressions which I'll come to very shortly.
Non-cyclic permutation just gives you horrible.
Well, it won't be that horrible, it's just that it'll involve the infinity twister, so you won't see a dual conformal invariance. That's what will happen. So it'll be longer, more complicated expressions involving the. Not so natural, but you could do it. I mean, there's nothing to stop you doing it. You can encode any function of the momenta in this way.
Excuse me, so if I write an SL4 invariant with four epsilon contracted with four W's, that would be a dual conformal invariant.
Yes, I'm going to come. Those are exactly the things that we're going to appear in a moment.
But then when I convert it to Z's, do the infinity twisters just disappear? Because you have these infinity when you convert it, you have these.
Yeah, it all comes out. The thing is, it would be the projective. If I have W1, W2, you mean you were getting at here, if I have that, and I translate each of them doing this, then the translation of that will indeed give some.
You'll have factors there too. So that,
that's true.
But the ratio. But it turns out that the ratios are the things of these nature in which I'm interested, which I'll be writing down very shortly, will show the conformal invariance.
Right.
I mean, this thing will have a weight here. You see, in 1, 2, 3, 4. So if you've got things of the essentially of weight
zero, then they'll translate into things of weight zero.
Right, so just think about the structure between the planes and the points is that of the lines, but the lines simply correspond to the region points, the XIs.
So that's,
and they don't care whether we think of them as being expressed in the twisters or the dual twisters. So that the anti-symmetrized product of Z1 and Z2 corresponds to the point X1A, but that in turn corresponds to the W1 and W2, and that's easy to see in
There's a picture in projective twister space. Here is the point x1. It's got z1 and z2 sitting on it. But also, you can sit of it, think of it as sitting in the planes given by w1 and w2. And the description of the line doesn't care whether you think of it as being formed out of two planes or out of two points. All right, so that picture then goes on to give a nice picture of how the whole loop works, because what you'll have, you start off with an x naught, and on it there's a z naught and a z1. Through the z1 there's another line, x1. And on that there'll be another twister, z2, and through that there's another point, x2, here's z3, and so on, right round the loop. And so the null separation, the fact that the momenta are null corresponds to the fact that the regions are null separated, and that corresponds to these lines meeting, and then the points where they meet, or equivalently the planes on which they meet, give you the momentum twisters or momentum dual twisters. So this is the picture. You can see from this, incidentally, that something special is going to happen if those two lines meet. And that's going to be the very condition which you mentioned here, that you've got a... If Z0, Z1, Z2, Z3 is 0 here, something special is going to happen because those two lines, which normally in general would be skew, will meet. And it's that... We'll see that particular invariant now coming out in the description of the scattering amplitudes. That's a genuine singularity for the scattering amplitudes. Some people will be more familiar with the CP5 description of points, but that really is essentially the same idea. So if you were familiar with that, you would have the idea that you were representing points with anti-symmetric two index tensors in four dimensions, so that they span a six-dimensional space non-projectively and give you a CP5. And then the condition that P and Q are null separated is that these, that this is zero, because the epsilon acts as the metric on the space. Sorry, that equals naught. But you see, the condition that happens is just the same as drawing those lines. That's just the same as the condition that there exists a z such that p alpha z is naught and q alpha is naught. So that condition, that degeneracy condition, implies that there's a point which is on the two lines, and equally well that there's a plane in which those two lines lie. So if you're more familiar with the CP5 picture in which points correspond to simple anti-symmetric tensors, then again, this is actually still a very natural construction. The only difference is I'm paying attention to these points which emerge in the case when two points are now separated. And this CP5 will come in useful later on. I'll just allude to things that you might do with it. Now we're in a position to translate all this stuff into new coordinates, because that's all it is. It's just now straightforward translation, which I think is All right, so let's start off with some natural things here. So S1, 2, I can write this in loads of ways. And from this, it's immediate, but I'm not going to use this abbreviated notation. So writing angle brackets, not 1, 2, 3, means that stands for epsilon. Thank you. that's the absolute symbol there, and divided by these are I alpha beta z naught.
So they're just the products of the pi
spinners, momentum spinners, that's all they are. They're just the familiar things here. This is the new thing here, this object.
And that's the thing which I pointed out as being something which has, you can see, a geometrical meaning. It's when two near, next to neighbouring lines hit each other. So.
Alright, so now the thing is that all the others are just as simple. That's very simple.
Right? That's nice and simple. But all the other things that we're interested in are equally simple.
Because this is the whole virtue of the this object is just as simple, and this is 0, 1, 3, 4 over 0, 1, 3, 4. That's just as
equally simple. It's on the same footing. And so on for all the others. But the really interesting one, that's not so interesting, but what is interesting is that these objects, which are absolutely endemic in all the expressions which come from this method of working out amplitudes, that is equally simple. And that, and that is given by that expression. This combination, notice, is not to do with just the meeting of two lines here. It's not of the form I plus 1, J plus 1. It's different. But it is nevertheless a very simple invariant of the momentum twisters. And that's really the key thing that's going on here.
Do you mean there's an
No, I think that's right.
I'm sorry.
That's right. It's not pretty obvious what it should be, but all right, so I can just plug all these into these big expressions and now let's see what we get. And, all right, so. Well, I get a lot of formerly non-invariant things. But these are essentially, this is really essentially the MHV, or Clark-Taylor part. And so what we get is that times a ratio function, which is, now I've got this denominator here. This is the spurious pole I drew attention to. I'm going to do the two-term expression, the one I've rubbed out. I'm going to do, pray for, it's going to start the wrong way. But the crucial thing is this now, is very simple. And it's that minus the same thing with 4 changed to 6. So it's that prefactor, which is essentially an MHV expression, times this factor, which now you can see has no infinity twisters in at all, and so it's automatically dual conformal invariant.
So this hairy thing of taking the x over x squared inversion is automatically encoded just in the form of that expression.
Right. So now you can stare at this spurious pole
with a rather clearer light, because what we've done is we've encoded into this algebra here
the delta function. So there's no need to look up these
non-linear relations every time we want to do an algebraic transformation. But we still, and it is now true, it is in fact a lot easier to see that if I take this expression and subtract away this expression, it is in fact going to be, it will vanish. The difference between these two will vanish
when 1, 2, 3, 5 is naught. And that's the salient point. But it still does require some algebra, essentially, with Schuten's identity applied over and over again. Well, that's established a major point here, because I could do the same thing for any of these amplitudes and study things, but I want to now show you what actually gives you an even greater insight into the nature of this subtraction and all the other things going on in here. This is a projective thing, whereas the original expression in momentum space is not a projective expression. It involves sums of momenta, which are not projective ideas. I've turned this entirely into a projective object, just as ratio. So it has this musical, this is harmony, the harmony of the amplitude has been re-established. All right, so the next step is to try and understand in a more invariant way what the significance of this is. And also, of course, I can translate these expressions, and I'll get some other things here, which are of the similar nature to these. And now, what on earth is the relationship between that two-term thing and a similar three-term expression
here? How do you know that and recognize that of those quartic things, which are physical singularities and which are unphysical?
Oh, that's easy. Yeah, because, yeah. It's simply because if they're of the form I plus 1, j plus 1, then they're physical. Then that corresponds to a thing of the form s something or other here, some sequence of moments. All right, so it is actually easy. Yeah, that's a very good point. So they all have that character, and that one doesn't. Yeah, those are exactly the ones which could possibly come in the total amplitude. Just an argument about what the final monograms are like. And this one, likewise, can't possibly be in there in the total amplitude. So they just must cancel. But now it'd be nice to find some reason, some way of seeing why they cancel. Mm-hmm. So that many little bit of geometry. Well, I'm going to give an analogue of what all this thing, all this business is to do with. But all this is BCFW is a method of partial fractions, and which I did it at school, and I always hated doing the algebra. Even just in one variable, I hated working out these things. And it was much nicer when I realized that you could cheat and never actually do the algebra, but just had to check that the residues were the same on both sides of the equation. And that's BCFW, basically. So you don't do the algebra, you cheat. So it just reminds you of what the one-dimensional thing that you might be doing for partial fractions is like. And where it goes wrong, we get the spurious poles. This is a typical thing that you'd be doing in complex analysis. You'd analyze that product of simple poles there into a sum of simple poles. I mean, this is standard sort of first year stuff. But of course, this doesn't work if E is equal to W. Because you've got a double pole here and you can't resolve it. But there's nothing wrong with this expression if E is equal to W. It's perfect. There's no singularity at all. It's the representation which has gone wrong. So that's an example. This is a spurious. There's a spurious singularity here. It isn't really there at all. So this is the analog. Now, if I want. All right, so that's very simple algebra, of course. And if I multiply up by the denominators, it's even simpler, because if I multiply up all the denominators, all I'm doing is showing that that's true. That's easy. But now let's think of this easy thing in a slightly harder way. I think of that as a line integral of dz from v to w to v, and that's equal to the sum going from w to z. So that gives you a geometrical idea, which you might write it projectively, would actually be more analogous to this, but I think this will do. The point is, it's a triangle idea. If you go there, it's the same as going there, and, or equivalently, three sides of the triangle add up to zero. So that's actually, that spurious pole effect can be thought of in this geometrical way. It's because you've represented, it's a case where this representation doesn't quite work, but the overall thing is geometrical meaning is something still clear. Well, what I'm going to do is the analogue of this, only two dimensions higher. So instead of being lines, sides of the line segments forming a triangle, it'll be, well, you'll see what it'll be, it's to do with tetrahedra. So the thing is, we have to stare at this expression here. So I'm not going to be interested in this prefactor part here. What I'm interested in is this dual conformally invariant ratio. I'll stare at that. And has it got any analogy to this geometrical picture? Well, you have to notice that it does, because the first term here, this term, the whole of that with the 1, 2, 3, 5, that's equal to it's that over a tetrahedron, so that the tetrahedron is bounded by four planes. And that's a picture of it. So I've got four planes, 1, 3, 4, and 5. Of course, you may notice it's a little bit artificial. I've got number 2 as the distinguished one here, and that's because of the way that I wrote this amplitude out in the first place. And that's the reason why 2 takes this different role. It's because it's sandwiched in the middle. That's asymmetry which goes away when we look at the full supersymmetric scheme. But I'm not going to go on to that. So that's the reason for it. If you're worried by that 2 playing some special role, that's the reason. It's because of the restriction to split helicity with the 2 fields sandwiched in the middle. It's got no great significance. All right, so the point is this has got these 4 vertices, and the vertices 1, 3, 5, 3, 5, 4, 1, 3, 4, and 1, 5, 4. So I do integrate that three-dimensional, in three-dimensional complex projective space. Integrate that over this, which you can visualize like that, and I obtain precisely this object. Now, what about a similar one with a 4 change to 6? Well, you can see what that's going to be. In fact, I can just do it by drawing another one on top. So instead of slicing it through with a 4 plane here, I'll slice it through with a 6 plane. 3, 5, 6, 1, 3, 6, 1, 5, 6. Now the subtraction of those just leaves a polyhedron with this shape. It's a chopped off tetrahedron like that. And that's round the back. So the complete amplitude, yeah, just a pyramid with the top knocked off.
Can it be suggested that
the
slicing is above the pyramid?
You shouldn't think these are not in real Euclidean space. The point of these pictures is they illustrate the incidences of lines and planes and points, which then carry over into a complex projective space. But they aren't really interiors and exteriors in the way that are being Euclidean space. So they give a correct picture of the... It's only a picture guide, not a definition of the space here. So there's no real inside or outside. So there aren't any special cases, things like that. I mean, in projective space, everything meets everything else, you see, so... So the difference thing is just this polyhedron. So the complete amplitude is simply the integral of that form over that polyhedron, now defined by 5 bounding planes taken in the order indicated by that picture. And now I can see why that vertex represents the sphere of singularity. And now you can see that actually it's not really there at all, you see. You can forget about it. Let me just rub it out, because it's not actually there. That's just a construction line. That's just a representation. This is the actual object here. It's this is this chopped off, is this polyhedron. And if I want, I can analyze and do this integral if I like by adding on that, by thinking there's a difference between two tetrahedra. Well, I might like to think of it a completely different way, when this and this vertex will never arise at all. It's just not there. So that gives you a geometrical picture, two dimensions higher up from the simple thing I mentioned about the triangle. It's two dimensions up because it's three. It's adding together tetrahedra rather than adding together line segments. All right. So now we can also get the mystery of why it's also equal to those three terms. Because now I just stick with that same thing. Well, actually, it's a little bit harder to visualize how you can chop that up into three tetrahedra corresponding to these three terms. So I'll do a slight cheating thing here, and I'll draw the dual picture to this. That is, say, drawing a plane as a point and a point as a plane. And if I do that, it becomes more transparent. And then it's just two tetrahedra sitting on top of each other. Let's see if I can get a nice picture of that. Yes, that's right. So that'll be like 4, 1, 5, 3, 6. I got one around the back there, yeah. Right, so it's just a tetrahedron sharing a common face, 1, 5, 3. That's the dual picture. So it has exactly the same information, it's only in the representation. It's not doing a different integral, I'm talking about the same integral, and I'm just drawing the picture of it in a different way to guide the eye. All right, so you can see this chopping off now is equivalent to the summation of the top tetrahedron and the bottom tetrahedron. But now, if I draw this line, 4, 6, well, now it becomes a complete 4 simplex, you see, and you can see there's a 5-term identity which expresses the fact that the 5 tetrahedral faces of a 4 simplex add up to 0. Or put it in more school geometry way, you can see that there's a tetrahedron, there are 3 tetrahedra with sharing the edge 4, 6. One like one this one and then 2 others. So put that line down the middle and you get a so that's the sum of so it's there's a 5-term identity. It's essentially thinking of what the 4-dimensional simplex is like, and that gives rise. Well, that's the thing which gives rise to this identity. So now we see another way in which we could have evaluated this integral and got the 3-term expression pretty well. So the whole thing is, that makes sense. The whole thing. Now, clearly, you could say, well, actually, I don't want to add any. See, all these expressions, they all depend on adding extra vertices in the primary picture, or extra planes in this picture here. So this one added the vertex here, but the others will add some other vertices out here, you see. But you could say, well, actually, I don't want to do that. I'll just divide up that polyhedron without adding any extra vertices at all. And that's easy to do, because all I need to do is to chop off. You can see how you can, well, that's what, millions of ways. I mean, it can cause all sorts of things, actually. But in particular, for instance, you could see you could just chop off that tetrahedron first, and then you do 2 more chops, and you get a 3-term decomposition of that object into tetrahedra, which don't introduce any spurious vertices at all. So you can do that, and you can write down the corresponding pieces of the integral that you get out of that expression. And that indeed gives you a new formula. Well, it's not a new formula, actually, because it was found 20 years ago, because it's the Baron-Skiers formula, which does only have physical pole singularities. And that corresponds exactly to this decomposition of the same polyhedron in this intuitive way. So, of course, you can do lots of other things. You could say, well, actually, I'll chop it up with some extra plane running, passing through it, any one you like. And those, essentially, the doing things like that gives you the CSW formulation or generalizations thereof. So that's another way of thinking of the same thing. So we have a picture now of what this in momentum, just the space, of what the complete amplitude looks like, as opposed to all these different, various different representations of it. Well, no, it's not exactly. No, this is only an observation about this amplitude, not a theory of how to get at the amplitude. So, yeah, so I think I'm very happy to make that distinction. This is only like a propelling one in a certain direction, a certain geometric ideas, which suggest there's certainly something there to be uncovered, but it's different from having a dynamical theory which is generating these things. It's certainly a very interesting structure. I think, now, I'll just indicate that if you want to do this, see, this is all restricted to the split helicity case, which means that the two fields got a special role. Essentially, everything's projected into the hyperplane of the two, and then we look at the geometry in that. But that's much too special. It turns out that to go up to the supersymmetric case, you have to do a little bit more work. But basically, you get polytopes in CP4 rather than these polyhedra in CP3, and then all the same ideas go through. So it's very beautiful polytopes in four-dimensional space, which have dihedral symmetry, and which correspond to the BCFW expansions of the NMHV amplitudes, but also which can be chopped up in these new ways, any way you like, in fact, in particular, into ways which have only physical poles, and that's been done. We published NEMA group, and I joined in, published a paper at the end of the year, which gave that explicitly, so I'll give references to that anyone who's interested. So it recovered these very old formulas as very special cases, but extended them to all n and all helicity positions. So I indicate, of course, this is, you could apply this idea of momentum twisters to more general cases. And we have a frontier. I mean, we don't know how to do this for the n squared MHV. Don't know how to give a geometrical picture. I mean, you can write down the algebraic expressions in momentum twisters for any amplitude you like, and they will have these conformal properties. But so giving a geometrical interpretation in this natural way is something that's, it's only been achieved in one other area, and that is the one loop MHV amplitudes. That's the other area. So I'll just introduce how you might, this is something where Nima's group have done an intense amount, so I mean, I'm sure he'll be speaking about this very thing. So this is just meant to be purely introductory on the geometry and the motivation here. But basically, you see, actually, it's really the CP5. If we're only talking about scalar things, then this really reduces to the CP5 formalism, so it's comparatively familiar. And in particular, if you've got some loop amplitude, I mean, a typical thing here is when you've got a loop, might have any number of things here, but normally you're thinking about 4, 5, or 6, not a huge number. But we've got a region space, and we've got some psi, j, whatever here. Now, if we look at what we're trying to integrate as the loop variable, well, the thing is, we give that turns into ZA, ZB, and all of these go into things like I plus 1, J, J plus 1. Okay, of course, there might only, because there are special cases here, where there's only one theorem as field coming out of the vertex. But a typical thing is that you can then represent the integrand here as the loop region, internal region X in its epsilon brackets with all these different momentum twisters, which now just appear as the CP5 skewed objects here. They're really quite familiar. And might have any number of these. But the thing is, you also have a numerator here. And by choosing suitable numerator here, which may not at all be obvious in the normal momentum space representation, you can have something which is conformally, the whole thing is conformally invariant here. So there's an art, and well, a science as well, I hope, to finding structures here which have got numerators that are certain of the appropriate kind, which make the whole thing of the correct homogeneity degree, but also conformally invariant. So a lot of the recent work has been built on developing that insight. So you get objects here which are not obvious ones at all, but which are built out of momentum twisters, not just out of the bi-twisters here, but using the actual twister structure. And these will certainly give rise to a whole load of new stuff, which I think Nemo will be discussing. And I'll just emphasize that there's something very, very simple about, let me just look at the traditional box integral things. If you look at the four mass box here, then you have four regions around the outside, which are, in the four mass case, are not null separated. So they correspond to four skew lines here, four lines which don't meet. So now such lines have exactly two transversals. Yeah, there are exactly two lines which cut all four of them. And those are just the same. Those are the leading singularities here, because those correspond to momenta which can run around here and be on shell. Because the fact they meet all of these means they're now separated from every region, and so meet the null condition. So the four mass case corresponds. This is a very simple geometrical picture, even though the algebraic expression for the on-shell momenta is actually very difficult. It's remarkably difficult to give, but the geometry is extremely simple. To see the degeneration to the three mass box, this becomes an on-shell zero mass thing on the outside here. Well, what's happening there is just that of these skew lines, now the whole situation changes radically because two of them meet at a point here, and the other set, the remaining ones, are skew. Again, geometrically, that's a very natural. Now, there are exactly two transversals, but the situation is rather different from before, because the two transversals aren't just two in the format case, you can't give a geometrical characterization of one rather than the other transversal. There's two solutions to the quadratic equation. But here, there's one which is distinguished by passing through the point where these two lines meet, whereas this one is distinguished by lying in the plane given by those two lines. So this naturally gives rise to the bifurcation of the amplitudes that you have here into the two different helicity types in a very, very natural geometrical way. So I'm just indicating really that type of geometrical structure is extremely natural to express. It just fits naturally into the momentum twister picture here. So indeed, twister structure as opposed to the bi-twister CP5 structure naturally arises in the geometry of studying these amplitudes. And lastly, the CP5 does play a role, because one of the things that we could do about regularization, or really the thing we could do about regularization, because we can't do dimensional regularization, we're using here the fact that 4 is the square of 2. It's not that it's 1 plus 3, it's the square of 2. In fact, I'd like to write up that equation. That's the fundamental equation of twister theory. And it's not that the 4 is 1 plus 3 is rather secondary.
Would it be 2 times 2?
Well, that's a very good point. And a very remarkable fact, and also I like all those equations, I like very much.
what do you precisely mean by that?
What I mean is that the fact that a null vector is factorized into two spinners is really the crucial thing which we're using again and again here. That's a fact, rather than thinking it as an EP, where the P could be extended to more than three dimensions. So, I suppose that's the point. But the CP5 allows for, it allows for translating this, and where you give a mass regularization to objects in a loop, because this translates into objects like, using this notation here, a typical thing there will look like that, which is still linear in AB when you do the integral over Z A and Z B here. It's still linear in that. It's still, this is simply AB contracted into an element of the CP5. So the linearity in CP5 can be effectively used to do things with the mass regularization here, and that's also been studied quite reasonably extensively. So that's another feature of the Mesmer systems. It does incorporate things that are natural in the CP5 point of view, and in particular this linearity here, something you can do the Feynman tricks with rather than doing the Feynman tricks in the Mesmer space in the usual way. Right, I think as much as I wanted to say about an introduction, so very happy to. Thank you for all the questions.
Any more questions, or we can talk to you.
You've told us this amazing geometrical fact that Yagnoski somehow knows about polytopes and CP4 polyhedrons and so on. What's the analogous state of Einstein gravity?
Well, I don't know where to start, because I haven't got the ordering, see? And the whole point is that this has got the complete
the
SN symmetry rather than the dihedral symmetry. And the ordering is absolutely essential for setting up this in a natural way. I mean, you can arbitrarily use these coordinates for gravitational amplitudes, but they wouldn't show any of this invariant structure.
Another question, which I don't know if it makes sense. Supposing that there's a civilization which you don't know about Yagnoski, but you know about polytopes and CP4, could you discover Yagnoski in that way?
Oh, I see. That's a funny question.
Well, he doesn't have Yagnoski yet. He just
has. Trump discovered the scattering amplitude and then
I suppose there's a Platonic side of me that would quite like that to be true, that they would know, they would have an intuitive understanding of four-dimensional geometry, and then you show them Yang-Mills theory and they say, oh yes, they say that, yes. All right, that's what you mean. Well, perhaps, maybe we just have to learn to think even more four-dimensionally than we do already.
The polytope that it has, really, you're rewriting the R function in terms of a token.
Yes, I shouldn't mention that. Yeah.
So we know that the higher non-MHV amplitudes are also just products of R functions. So why is that not interpreted?
Yes,
not products of
polytope. They're not just direct products. I don't think I know. Lionel's grappled with this more than I have, I think. It's something that's very much in the air at the moment, I think, is just trying to establish how that product structure can carry over into a geometrical structure. I just feel it's almost, we're very close, but it's not quite there. But I mean, I agree with you that it seems at the natural next step to make here.
Essentially,
the problem is just with the sort of boundaries, you get these R invariants with extra indices, and in this five bracket language, all that is that the twisters you insert into the five brackets are not twisters that were part of the external data, but they're sort of slightly shifted.
Yeah.
And they're shifted depending on the amount that was, depends on the twisters that you put into the other five brackets.
Well, that's a very geometrical idea, really, and therefore we ought to be able to incorporate it.
It's not quite just a product.
It's not just a product.
You take an integral across an interval, you get a square, but this thing's not going to be a square, you're going to slice the corners off the square.
So somehow you've got to just correlate the
triangles you've got top with the
shifts. I'd very much encourage anyone to think about this, because there's a really juicy question that's open now, is to find a very nice description of these higher order things. So that's just the state that it's in at this moment.
I thought you said there was. There is or there is not a description of arbitrary
No, it's not. You can write down the algebraic expressions, all right, but if you give this kind of geometrical description showing the unity of the amplitude in a geometrical way, that's not done. But above k equals 1 tree, or the MHV, one loop. All these But the whole pattern of these pieces all adding together in lots of different ways is extremely noticeable at all the higher amplitudes. That's the very thing. It calls out for
this description. But you can write down the formulas that exhibit no spurious poles.
In fact, that has been done certainly for a class of k equals 2 amplitudes, but it hasn't. That hasn't in itself given the illumination that we need. But so I feel it's not far off. I mean, this is just something very much in progress.
So something you said in passing was that these formulae are just the bare scalar formula.
These ones are. I haven't written down what they are. What I claimed was that if I chop this polyhedron in the way which doesn't create any new vertices, then you'll get those. Yes. It does.
That's what obviously, neither of them have spurious singularities, but they're really identical.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, they are.
And is that true for these higher n squared and h etc.?
I don't think they have ever been written down before. So.
Even the Baron scalar.
I don't think so.
There is something with Kassauer for NMHB for arbitrary numbers of letters, but you probably don't want to look at that
form. I don't know what I've seen that one. That's also horrible.
Yeah. Would you expect to see anything in six dimensions that might look like this that you could reduce to four?
I expect the next thing to be eight dimensional here. I mean, because they're basically products, the next things are expected to be essentially eight dimensional.
Can you elaborate on that? The next thing is 8 by 6.
Well, because these are three dimensional, but this is artificially three dimensional because I'm talking about split helicity. These are really four-dimensional. These are really hyperfaces of a four-dimensional polytope. That's what they are. So it's really CP4 objects. Yeah, four-dimensional. So it's essentially the squares of those which come into the stage. In fact, I might mention just one thing about the four polytope. It's a very beautiful thing, and it's that the four polytope which is the right one for doing this the appropriate integral in the general NMHP. Is in a very definite sense the square of the polygon of the Wilson loop polygon. It's the polytope you get by multiplying all the edges of the polygon together and forming tetrahedra, all possible tetrahedra, that and then finding the four polytope of which that is the boundary, which that collection of tetrahedra is the boundary. So that's completely well defined operation. So it's very the sense in which it's simply the square. The polytope is just the square of the I haven't got it now, it's gone, but the original polygon, which is just simply this ordered list of super momenta. So it's a very, very simple structure now.
What is it, the square?
Well, it's the square it's a square in the sense that it's a four-dimensional object, which is a square of essentially two-dimensional object, a polygon. But it's quite explicitly, you just take the edges, I plus 1, and j plus 1, it's the sum over all of those. It's the sum over all the tetrahedra formed in that way. That gives you a three-dimensional object, but that's the boundary of a unique four-dimensional object, which is the polytope of interest.
That's
an invariant description of it.
Polygon is defining a Wilson loop.
Yeah.
Then the NMHV tree is just coming from a single propagator stretched between pairs of edges, and of course you're just somewhere over. You know, one of them goes around II plus one, the other edge, the other end of your propagator goes around JJ plus one, somewhere. That's why you're getting these pairs. It's just telling you which pairs of edges of the polygon you're propagating.
It's the space of paths across a Wilson loop. That's what we've got at. But honestly, that's an emergent property. I mean, I've introduced this in the way of looking at these crazy rational functions and trying to find some pattern on them. What's emerged out of that is this connection with a Wilson loop, which has really come from completely other ADS people's work, completely different point of view. So there's a very beautiful sort of confluence of ideas going on here, which hopefully is the thing which will continue up to at much higher levels. It's also true in the MHV1 loop. The structure of interest is again it's polygon times polygon, which is the important structure, four dimensional structure. So 2 times 2 is 4 again. You see, that's my final word on that. Yeah.
Well, thanks again.